Hello, welcome to Same Shit, Different Brain, Series 2, Episode 12, with me, Rebecca Ryder. I hope you've had a good few weeks. I've had a bit of a break from podcasting, but I'm glad to be back. I've been planning my first ever event for Same Shit, Different Brain, which I'm so excited about. It's called How to Make Friends and Find Community as an Adult, and I'd love you to come along if you're in the Manchester area on the 11th of August. 8,200 people search How to Make Friends every single month. Check out the episode description for the link to the event page with all the details. This time on the podcast, I speak to Rochelle Hanslow. Rochelle's an author, chronic illness and mental health writer, podcaster and Emmy Support UK ambassador. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with the wonderful Rochelle, who's doing incredible work promoting more education and challenging misconceptions around lesser understood physical and mental health conditions. We discussed a range of important topics and issues, including misunderstandings around day-to-day difficulties of chronic illness, the relationship between body image and chronic illness, how animals help mental health, and the lack of compassion around pet bereavement, which Rochelle's debut children's book, How to Rest on a Rainbow, was based on. We also talked about the gaps in knowledge and support for neurodiversity in children and adults, including ADHD and autism, having a parent come out as transgender in childhood and dealing with the heartbreaking prejudice that affected her family, and coping with the trauma of an emotionally abusive relationship and the journey to regaining a sense of self. I hope you enjoy, and if you like the show, please take a minute to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or rate it on Spotify. Morning, Rochelle.
Morning.
You okay?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Yourself?
Good. Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. So how's the school holidays treating you?
Not great.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Whereabouts in Scotland are you?
I'm just outside of Stirling.
Oh, okay. I went to the Cairngorms at New Year last year, not far from Aviemore, mm-hmm. A little place called Kingussie. It was gorgeous. But yeah, I love Scotland. Want to get back there again this year, definitely. So how is your day going today then?
It's not too bad, but I am feeling a bit deflated today.
Right.
My youngest son has chicken pox.
Oh, no.
And both my sons were ill last week. Because they picked up a cold at a birthday party that they went to. So that's why the summer holidays have had a really disappointing start to them. So it's just because they've already been through so much during term time.
Yeah.
It's just disappointing because I thought finally 7 weeks, a bit of a break for them. They can recoup. We can really have some, nice times together, some good walks and things like that. And now they've been ill.
Oh, bless them. Well, I hope it's out of the system soon.
Thank you.
Get on with enjoying it, feeling free.
Hope so.
Do you have lots of places for nice walks around where you live then?
Yes, definitely. We've got the Ochil Hills, literally right on our doorstep. Then about 20 to 30 minutes drive, we've got Loch Vennachar and Loch Lubnaig, which are two of our favourite lochs. So we've got those, and there's lots of different places that we can walk around as well. So we're lots of forests that we like to kind of adventure to.
Oh, it sounds great. Yeah, that's what I love about Scotland. It's just incredible, breathtaking when you get to those lochs and those big forests. I absolutely love it, just roaming around feeling free with no one around. Yeah, for miles.
Definitely. And I couldn't survive in a city. It's okay for a visit, but I couldn't settle in a city.
Yeah, that it's a drastic change of pace, isn't it? Like when I was younger and I lived in city centre, I thought I'm a city girl, thought it would never change, and then the older you get, you just need to breathe a bit and step away from people. So what led you to start writing then? I mean, I'm guessing it was always a passion for you, but obviously it's great that you've started writing professionally and you've written a book and everything. And I know that you write articles as well about things that you're passionate about, and you've written a couple of really great ones for me, which I'm really grateful for. I'm really excited to show to everyone. So do you want to explain a bit about your journey with that and how you got started with it as a career as well?
Yeah, no problem. But like you say, when I was younger, I was always writing.
Yeah.
And I loved writing creative essays and writing projects in school. That was where I excelled, and that's where I really came out of my shell. And in my teens, I wrote poetry and lyrics, and I had a bass stint in a garage band.
Oh, nice.
And then from that, I was sure that I wanted to be a music journalist when I left school.
Yeah.
But the problem for me was that I didn't want to go to university right away, because I didn't
Oh.
want more of the same. Because I loved learning and the things I was passionate about, but it was the people. I couldn't stand it. So after I took a little bit of time out and did a little bit of a job, then I went to college to do like a kind of media course in that. But that was a complete disappointment for me because they focused more on the PR side of the media
Yeah.
and not really much on the actual writing or journalism side, and I just totally lost my interest with it, and left the course. Just thought, no, I'm not going to waste any more time because it's just not for me.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my late teens, and then in my early 20s I unfortunately got in a relationship that was completely toxic,
Oh no.
and he made me lose everything within myself, my confidence, my spark, just everything.
Oh,
And with that, writing and drawing went out the window as well.
yeah.
And it's really only been in recent years, through working on self-awareness and trying to quiet and down the conditioning that we're put through, in our lives, to that I've kind of gone back to it and thought, you know what? This is me. Like, it's not something I choose, it's ingrained in me, you know. And I know I'm lucky because there's a lot of writers who say, well, I've sat down to do like an article or a blog post, and you know, I'm just struggling with it. But for me, I can sit there and it just comes.
That's good.
And that's when I know, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
It's incredible, isn't it? Like when you sort of work on finding your happiness again, how that creativity can just flow back, and then you feel quite sad that you kind of lost that, but it's a really good indicator of where you're at within yourself, I guess. And I mean, having a voice for writing, being able to express yourself and like knowing your own voice is an incredibly empowering thing, isn't it? And I mean, if you don't struggle with the writer's block as well, then you've absolutely nailed it. Because it's like
Yes.
one of the biggest issues with people who do love writing, but they sit there and they just they don't know how to put pen to paper, so to speak.
Definitely. I think as well with writing, people kind of think, oh, I'm not good for like essays or books or whatever, but it doesn't have to be like that. Sit down and journal. Even journaling, that it's such a powerful tool,
Really,
and it really can just ignite something.
100%. Yeah, but over the past couple of years, I mean, I definitely picked it up again, maybe just before the pandemic, that went properly over the pandemic. Obviously, we all had a bit more time, and ever since then, I just haven't stopped. And I've got like multiple journals, and I don't know what I'd do without them now. So, yeah, transferring that into something that can connect with everyone is a brilliant thing.
Yes, definitely.
And like you say, it doesn't really matter about the medium, does it? Like you can, I think that you can sort of restrict yourself with that and thinking, how should I be writing this for this particular, like, is it going to be an essay, or is it going to be a blog, or is it going to be something that goes into a magazine? But I mean, as long as you're speaking about your experience authentically, it's going to connect with someone, I think.
Yes, definitely. And the thing for me is, one of the keys for writing is to write well, you have to write what you know.
Yeah,
And I
definitely.
think that's kind of where it comes naturally.
Yeah, 100%. I tried to sort of build up to that myself with, like getting confident with, first of all, you need to know what's going on in your own head anyway, which is why like journaling's so great to sort of get clarity on that. And then from there, you can then speak to other people on it. And I've sort of hoped myself that I could get to a place where I could feel comfortable to speak about my own experiences and hope that it would help other people in a way that's being like really honest, like the bits that we're scared to share, it can be really intimidating, can't it? But yeah, from what I've written of your work, it's fantastic. And I know that one of them about pet bereavement, that was the subject of your book, wasn't it? That was your first book, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Yeah. A children's book. It was aimed specifically at children, but I imagine it would help a lot of parents as well.
Yes. And I think that's the nice thing about it is I wanted it to obviously help them through that difficult time, but it's a book that they can go to over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's just not really, like, I know you mentioned everyone uses this common language of going to Rainbow Bridge, and that's about as far as it goes, isn't it? And it's, I know my experiences of like losing pets when I was younger, I'm still not sure whether some of them actually ran away or died, because it's like protecting children's feelings around these things. It's understandable, but then how do they then, at what point do then they start to acknowledge and deal with grief in a real way? So it's a really valuable thing.
And I think the most important thing as well is not to dumb children down.
Yeah. You know,
they're not, like, they're more intuitive than a lot of people think. And I know for my children, at least, they had so many questions. And just saying, oh, he's gone to Rainbow Bridge would never have sufficed. It would be, well, how did he get there? What does he do there? You know? So I think it was good to have that knowledge as well, because it helped in the creating of it.
Yeah, definitely. I can imagine. Yeah, it's a really lovely thing. And in terms of other children's books, is that something that you'd want to continue expanding on, or are you just not restricting yourself? Are you just kind of going to see which feels right and right for adults, if that feels right to do next, or what's your sort of plan there?
Yeah, I've released 3 self-published children's books so far. I'm working on my 4th, but I actually get a lot of ideas from my eldest son. He's really imaginative and creative, and he loves books as well. We're very alike on that kind of manner.
Yeah.
And we kind of off each other. It's kind of like, and I can be like, well, I had this idea. And he's like, oh, it could be like this, Mum, you know. So it's kind of nice.
Yeah.
So there's definitely more children's books in the making. I'm working on a short story collection just now for adults, and it's going to be 12 different people and 12 glimpses into living with different chronic illnesses, and how that can be looked upon on so many different levels, because it is something that affects lots of people very differently. And I'm also working on my memoir as well.
Fantastic. Oh, that's brilliant. That's really exciting. You've got enough to be keeping you busy then, keeping the creativity flowing.
Yes, definitely.
I know, the other article you wrote for me around body image and when you have a chronic illness was really enlightening. It's absolutely brilliant. And I think that's going to speak to a lot of people, either people who are living with chronic illness or people who just weren't aware. You know, I mean, you touch on things like is it like nutritionists and like physical trainers, and the way that these sort of markets don't often cater for people with chronic illness, and things like the body positivity movement. I know I'd heard of body neutrality. That's like the latest iteration of it, isn't it? But I really sort of properly understood it the way that you explained it in that article. It was really fantastic.
Thank you. I'm glad.
Yeah, it's great. So is that something that you've sort of found in the past? Did it come from like a frustration that you've experienced for a long time? Is it something that you just felt was really important to speak about?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. Because the people don't kind of think about these kinds of things. They just think chronic illness, oh, you just sleep all day. You're just lazy, you're just lying on a couch, you know, just get up and do something, you'll feel better. And it's just not like that at all. And especially, as I've said, there's so many factors, medication that can pile on weight, and you could be doing the best you can with nutrition, you could be moving as much as you can, but there's nothing you can do when you rely on a medication that completely piles on weight.
Yeah.
And as somebody who obviously has suffered with body image, even before I was diagnosed, it was so difficult for me to see my body change so much so quickly, because not only was I losing mobility at times and kind of muscle function and things like that, my weight went up, then I started to get hold of it, my weight went back up again. And then obviously when depression and things kind of kick in, because you're just dealing with all this grief all the time, that can also then be like, what am I doing here? Like, you just feel like you take one step forward to take 10 back. So I think it was something that definitely needed to be highlighted.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic that you could take that and then create something really powerful out of it, and, you know, speaking about these things and basically highlighting people's ignorance is the only way to sort of make change. And, you know, I'm really sorry that you've been through that, but it's fantastic what you're doing from it as well. And coming back actually to your other article around pet bereavement for a second, the adult aspect of that, the other thing that was really interesting is how it's treated in the workplace when people lose a pet. It's not really taken very seriously at all, and in fact it's just downright shunned a lot of the time, isn't it? And it's really sad, because loads of us know like how much our pets mean to us, and you know, a lot of the time it's no different than a human loss, even more so, you know, with your pet all the time. So I mean, I haven't ever been through it, but I've had my dog for 11 years now, so things like this, when I read them, they're so reassuring for me, because I just don't see resources out there that much that deal with it in such a honest way, and you know, highlight what needs to be done to change. So yeah, thank you for writing that as well. Is this something that sort of really affected you as well with one of your previous pets?
Yes, definitely. I've had two dogs. My childhood dog, he was 16 when he passed, but he got me through so much in my childhood. I had a lot of family things going on. We were in the 90s, you know, when I was around about 4, and one of my parents came out as transgender at the time. So that was a huge taboo. I mean, even now, we've obviously still not got the priorities straight in regards to transgender people and many people, humanity on whole, really. But back in the 90s, in a small town in Scotland, that was, you know, that wasn't great. So there was a lot of upset and emotion around that. And I was never a very an extroverted person anyway. I've always kind of liked to keep myself to myself, but that kind of solidified it. So I always got so much more comfort from animals than I ever did people. And that's why I say now, I'm not an introvert, I'm not an extrovert, I'm a canine introvert. Because I would rather spend my days with dogs than anybody else.
Yeah, fully embrace that, yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that at all. In fact, I'm saying that, but that is what I do. Spend all day with my dog. It's like the big perk of working for myself and working from home.
Yes, definitely. And then obviously for me, it was my dog, Vader. He was a black Labrador, got him in 2008, and he passed away in late 2018. And it was such a shock when he passed. We didn't even know he was ill. He had been absolutely fine, and then within a matter of hours he just went completely downhill. And we actually found out that he had a tumor that we didn't obviously know about it. But that just I'm no shame at all that it broke me, and I'm still broken from it. I mean, I miss him so much, but that's because I kind of feel like he was my doggy soulmate.
Yeah.
And he was there for me during my whole diagnosis of chronic illness.
Yeah.
So then I kind of felt like doctors were against me and the medical profession was against me. The kind of society on whole was against me. I lost friends, family members just didn't understand.
God.
And then I was just like, you know, he was there the days that I couldn't get out of bed. He was beside me, making me laugh, making me safe. And I mean, he was actually the one who alerted my husband. I collapsed, and this is why diagnosis started.
Yeah.
I had thought I had a chest infection. I'd got up, I was getting ready to go to work at the time, started to feel a bit faint, came out of the bathroom to call my husband, and I just hit the floor before I could even shout.
Oh, wow.
It was on the top of our staircase. So I went down a couple of stairs and I hit my head. And it was actually Vader came running through. He was trying to lick me and things because my husband said when he picked me up, I was so like so wet. That he ran back through to the bedroom and he jumped on the bed and he would not stop pawing at my husband and barking at him until he got up.
Oh.
And then he came right over to me, and the rest of the time he didn't leave my side.
Oh God, they're so clever, aren't they? They're so intuitive.
Yeah. And that's why I think people just don't understand, because I love my children, but I'm not sure my children would have that much devotion.
It's so true. It's just unconditional love from dogs, isn't it? Like, you can't understand it unless you have one. And yeah, my dog's really tuned into my emotions and everything. So it's no surprise that, you know, you hear about people who have like actual physical conditions. I mean, even they can smell cancer, can't they? So
yeah.
I've heard about dogs alerting people to having like lumps in the breast that they had to get checked out. It turns out they were cancer just by like pawing at them. And yeah. Oh yeah, they're lifesavers, literally.
Yeah, Vader did that quite a few times. There was a couple of times he stopped me from having an asthma attack during the night.
Really?
Managed to like jump on me and wake me up in time for me to get my inhalers. When I was pregnant with my second son, just before, it was about maybe a couple of weeks before I had him, I got a kidney infection. But for about 3 days before, I kept saying to my husband, Vader keeps jumping up and going to the like my back.
Oh,
and
he won't
let me sit back on like, you know, like the chair. I don't know what's going on. And he was trying to tell me that there was something wrong.
Oh, it's just amazing. They're just magical. Like, how could we not need time to grieve that? Do you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
So right, like things have to change in that regard. Like, I'm sure there are some employers who are really great, but they're definitely very ahead of the curve when it comes to that, because I don't hear of compassionate leaves, that's it.
Yeah.
I don't hear of that being applied to animals very often, but it really, really affects people. I mean, I know people who are therapists and they deal specifically in that area because it needs, you know, the same kind of support as anything else when it's had such a big impact on your life.
Definitely. And a lot of people kind of bypass the fact that you can actually get PTSD from something like that, because it depends obviously how the animal passed, you know.
Yeah.
And if it's been attacked or you've witnessed that, that was, you know, a lot of people see them as their children. So yeah. If, you know, a human child was viciously attacked or run over or something, nobody would just dismiss it and say, oh, it was only a kid.
No, exactly.
You know, and it's, I think that's a lot of the time, it's your perception of things.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, like people call them their fur babies now, and that's, yeah, basically are like kids, aren't they?
Definitely.
It's definitely a lot of responsibility, and you get the same amount of love. I think I'm not a parent yet, but yeah, it's they definitely have a whole lot of love to give. And just for a second, to I don't know how much you want to talk about it, but just to give a nod to your parent who came out at that time, that's so, wow, how courageous. Like you say, at that point, when we're not even at a place now where there's enough acceptance and love in society, as you say, like back in the 90s, that must have been really tough. Like, was there kind of a mixed reaction from everyone around you, or was it largely negative, or did people not want to address it?
I was quite young. Like I say, I was only four. When it happened, so I was, I saw a lot of it and I took a lot of it in. But I think it's as I've gotten older, I've actually found out more and more truth, and it's just harrowing, to be quite honest. Because I know my experience, like most of the children and my peers were quite cruel. You know, it was just yet another thing to pick on me for. You know, I was a little bit chubby. I had glasses when I was about 9 or 10. And then obviously this was another thing just to throw into the fire, you know. And I know for me, I had an experience of like bullying and prejudice and things like that. And I think one of the things that I noticed most was that people in society didn't care that my parents had children when they were with them, when they were thrown abuse.
Oh my God.
You know, we heard it all.
Yeah.
And there was even times where I was staying with this parent because they had to move away. They had no choice. So I was staying with this parent.
Oh God.
And they got death threats and things through the letterbox. People found out where they were staying. And it was awful, you know, and again, perception, we're already going through enough. Your judgment is not needed to that. Like, you can't possibly know how it felt, you know? And, so yeah, I've always seen it from, one of the things I always do is try and see it from everybody's kind of point of view.
Yeah.
And you know, honor my own feelings about it, but understand that they've had their feelings, and you know, try and kind of mash it all together to see one big picture.
Yeah, well, they're scared, aren't they? That's what it is. It comes from fear. That doesn't justify it at all, but that's basically all it is, because it doesn't affect them, you know. It's not a choice that's made to hurt them. It's something that comes from a very real place, and a lot of people don't even acknowledge that in themselves. So it's, you know, fantastic that your parent did actually own that and come out with it, and, you know, dealt with whatever came back from that. And it, like I say, even in today's world, coming out as transgender would be hard enough. So yeah, that's fantastic. And that's obviously been passed down to you, that you took from that you just want to spread love around that and spread awareness around that. And you know, you'll never have the attitude that these people who are speaking out of fear will have. So yeah, I think a lot of good can come from that, the more that people just own themselves, their own authentic selves, really.
That's it. And that's what it should be about. Like, I don't feel that anybody has the right to judge anybody else.
No.
You know, and I don't even think it's been a fact of, obviously, going through this, as you say, it does open your eyes and you see it in a whole different way. But it's just compassion, isn't it? It's compassion, it's kindness. It's, I know for me, I would hate anybody saying, well, you know, I don't want you to be seeing that person, or why do you love that person? Or, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? It grinds on me. So I can only imagine how it must feel to try and just be yourself and be told that, you know, it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, it's completely unfair, and I can only guess that somehow people are having their own identities threatened by seeing that other people are showing what's possible, you know. And it's a shame that they have to think like that, but I guess their own experiences of what they've been through and what they've been shown it's possible, they somehow feel it isn't right for some reason. But yeah, hopefully things are going in the right way in a lot of places as well, I hope. So do you also want to tell me a little bit about your work as an ambassador for ME Support UK? Because that sounded really fantastic as well.
Thank you. Yes, I've been ambassador for ME Support UK since 2015.
Mm-hmm.
I actually found Louise when I was online trying to research the illnesses that I had, but I was also looking for charitable favours, wedding favours for our wedding at the time. And that's how I found her. And it was the first website that I'd found that had a lot of information that I hadn't seen before, and it was common sense. And I think for me as well was knowing that Louise had a whole experience of it, because she is also chronically ill. Because a lot of these kind of websites and things, they come off from, well, this is what you should be doing, but they're not actually a sufferer. That was one of the things I think that makes Louise stand out, is that she can give the advice and compassion, and she understands. Mm-hmm. And we kind of just kept in touch from there. She asked me to write a kind of personal essay article for the website, and just kind of detailing my journey up until that point. Mm-hmm. And it went from there. I had been ambassador for a ME research charity in 2014, but I stepped away from it because I was finding that fundraising was really difficult. It was always the same people dipping into their pockets. Nobody was kind of getting into it and sharing, and you know, and that's what you need for these kinds of things. And just being in the first kind of early stages of diagnosis, I just didn't have the energy to chase people all the time. But then Louise had said that she needed an ambassador, or she was looking for a volunteer ambassador. And I said, you know, I'll give it a go, you know, see what it's like. And I'm still there. And obviously I've written more articles for her, content for the website, reviews. I mean, the main thing is obviously just supporting Louise and her and what she wants to do with ME support. She's been doing this for almost 22 years now, and she's done it all by herself. She doesn't get any extra help. Obviously, she has the team of volunteers, but we're very small, and most of us are also chronically ill. And she does it all out of her own pocket as well. She doesn't have any funding or anything like that. So she's really a voice for the chronically ill community. And it's great to be a part of. And especially when, you know, I'm now the sole contributor to the blog, and I have been since the start of 2021. Okay. And it's just nice to know that Louise has that faith in me that I can deliver the messages that she would want on her website and for our community.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds fantastic. Sounds like a really good outlet. I mean, as I mentioned earlier about it, you know, you've been able to turn it into an empowering thing, speaking about your experiences honestly. I mean, yeah, being this ambassador role just kind of encapsulates that. When you're still, like you say, in the early stages of your own diagnosis and figuring things out, it's really generous that you'd share that with other people in order to help them and make sense of things for themselves as well, and figure out how to, I mean, is it like a lot of advice mainly, sort of resources? Is that mainly what it's based around?
Yeah, it's about advice for anybody. People think, oh, it must just be like for the chronically ill, but it's not. It's a lot of the time we need the support from people outside of the community to get people, like, you know, the doctors and things listening to us. So it really is about the awareness, and that's the biggest thing. Louise obviously wants to support the community as much as possible, and it's not just catered to ME. There's also people with fibro as well, and for fibromyalgia, and all different kinds of chronic illnesses. And Louise will always try and help as much as she can, and whether it be about medications, whether it be about doctors, whether it be financial advice, she's trying to, you know, help and cover as much as possible.
Brilliant. Yeah, one of my friends, Christy, was a guest in a previous series. She has fibromyalgia, and I hadn't known a whole lot of how debilitating that could be as well before she spoke about it. So, like you say, when there were so many misunderstandings about these conditions, raising awareness to people who don't have them is one of the most important jobs, really, isn't it, I imagine?
Definitely. And I think people need to be aware of the fact that we don't get a lot of support from medical professionals. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing about that is that the information just isn't there for them to get the proper training to deal with chronically ill people. And it's just a vicious cycle, mm-hmm. you know? So there's a lot of research going into a lot of the chronic illnesses, but the funding's not there. And it's like, again, another, you know, vicious cycle. So it's just about getting the support where we can, and knowing that even just friends and family start to understand that you didn't choose this, you're not being lazy, you're not, you know, ignoring people. It's just an overwhelming life to kind of have to get used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. It's amazing work that you're doing. So yeah, it's impressive. Like the power of writing as well. Like, it just can't be underestimated, can it? It's it's really fantastic. What's been the most rewarding aspect of your writing and ambassador work?
My main aim in writing is to always be the person or the voice that I've needed so many times in my life. So if my writing can resonate with someone, if it can make them feel less alone or make them, you know, stop and think and maybe reevaluate the way they've been towards somebody or the way that they've thought about, you know, chronic illness or mental health or anything like that, I think that's really the ultimate reward. And getting messages and comments about my writing saying that it's helped somebody, or if they feel that a piece has really just resonated and will make a change and they'd like to share it with other people, that's again, it's a huge compliment, and it's something that just, it makes my soul happy, really.
Oh, I bet, yeah. I mean, you can't ask for much more than that, can you? Apart from a shed load of money, I guess, and a top selling book one day, the New York bestseller list.
Yeah, that would be nice. But I think for me, if you want big money, writing's not the
end. You can't go into it for that. Definitely don't bank on that. You've got to have a love for it. I can't imagine being a writer and not having a passion for it. I mean, I guess there are a lot of people in marketing doing it who aren't exactly crazy about it, but yeah, to be a good writer, it comes from a place of real love, definitely. So in terms of yourself, what are the things that impact your own mental health the most?
Well, actually, I've recently just realised that I have undiagnosed ADHD, which is obviously now adding to the chronic illnesses, the multiple chronic illnesses that I have already coped with. And on top of that, my husband and my eldest son are also neurodivergent.
Wow, yeah.
So it's never boring. No. Our life is never boring. But obviously, for all of us, it's different. We handle situations differently. And we obviously, all of us have things that, again, unfortunately, there's still so much stigma around. So it's a constant fight. For my eldest son, Mason, it was a constant fight to get him the help he needed in school, because they were like saying he didn't present as an autistic person. Mm-hmm. Well, that's called masking, you know. We get used to it. We see how people feel we should function and we adapt. Because he does that all day at school, and he comes home and that's when the meltdown happens. You know, it's the overwhelm, it's all the emotions of the day. It's just constantly fighting. I mean, my husband didn't get diagnosed until adulthood, because again, in childhood, you know, back in the 90s and early noughties, it again just wasn't taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. He was just told that he was, you know, a bit of a nuisance in school.
Especially, you know, for boys, it's just written off like that, isn't it? Just boys being boys, just being naughty boys. And in girls, like you say, when girls are masking in a different way, so it probably just gets overlooked completely in most cases.
Yeah, definitely. And it was actually myself that started the ball rolling for him to get diagnosed.
Yeah.
Because he kept saying to me, like, I want, like, the help. And he didn't care about a formal diagnosis because it really doesn't change anything. He obviously knew that there was something going wrong. He didn't see the world the same as other people.
Mm.
And I kept telling him, but that's okay. But his whole life, he's been told that it wasn't. It wasn't okay. So, yeah, it's been battle after battle for him as well. And obviously with being chronically ill, again, as I've mentioned, there's so many areas that you have to battle.
Yeah.
So those are the things I think that get my mental health the most. I also do feel like other people can make your life so much more stressful and complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah.
So that's the main areas, I think, trying to balance as well, because it makes sense to me now with having the undiagnosed ADHD about the energy levels and why I can get so overwhelmed so quickly.
Yeah.
And obviously it's the mental energy level, but as well as with the chronic illnesses, it's the physical. So it's making sure that I've kind of always got that balance, and getting that balance isn't easy.
No.
Especially obviously when I've got other people who do depend on me so much.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And if you don't mind me asking, I know you said about the diagnosis doesn't always matter. So did you decide not to pursue a medication route for ADHD?
I'm just starting out on the diagnosis route.
Right.
But my husband, he got his full diagnosis, but they said because of his age, that was it. Like, you've got to deal with it.
Oh, really?
He wasn't given any kind of medication offer. He was told that there was probably going to be kind of groups that he could go to in the area that would be getting built up within the next 4 years. And that he would be put on a list for that. And he got diagnosed 6 years ago, and we've still had nothing. So it's really, I think that's one of the things that we can understand, is that with my chronic illnesses, it was, this is your diagnosis.
Yeah.
Go deal with it. You know, so I understand that from a husband as well. And it's been a fight trying to just get our son for diagnosis, more so that he can get the correct support, because he's still young,
yeah.
You know, and I want to make sure that he thrives in his education and he thrives in the rest of his life, whatever kind of way he wants to pursue it.
Yeah.
So it's been, we are now on the list to have our diagnosis, but it's looking like my eldest is currently six. And it said that he's probably going to take at least 18 to 24 months before he gets an appointment. And it could take a further 2-3 years after that to get a final diagnosis.
Oh, my God.
So he's probably going to be leaving primary school before we actually get a diagnosis.
Right. I mean, the good thing about it being genetic, I suppose, is that when it does present in the children as well as the parents, and the parents do have an awareness of it, they have sort of diagnosis, or they've recognised, you know, recognised it for what it is, then at least the parent then knows how to help the child adapt and work with their own brain to the best of their potential, you know, because it doesn't mean they have less potential. It just means neurodivergent means brain works in a different way. It doesn't mean that it's, doesn't mean that it's a dysfunction or anything like that. I mean, obviously there are areas of difficulty you have to learn to work with, but yeah, there's definitely a lot of misconceptions around that as well. Like there are a lot of really great like superpowers as well with neurodivergent brains, and learning to recognize those are just as rewarding, I think. But I know there's a thing called Right to Choose in the UK, but would that just be in England? Is it not something that was available in Scotland?
I'm not sure. we've had very little kind of information about what is available to us and what's not. And I think it's probably until he gets actual diagnosis. Thankfully for me, like, I wasn't having any of the school's nonsense.
No.
So I myself went to educational psychology. I was just like, you have to help, you know. They were already involved within the school anyway. So I went directly to them. And since they've come in and made the school more aware that actually Mason is masking and he's doing all these different things, that he actually, you know, is showing the signs, you just didn't know which ones to look for. So they are being a lot more supportive. And I don't even mind that they're not as supportive towards myself, as long as Mason gets the support he needs. And they have been, obviously, after summer, he'll be transitioning into his next primary class. The class changes, the teacher changes, you know, so it's a lot of changes again for him every year. So they've done a lot more in regards to that, because it's one of his triggers. He doesn't like change. And he does take a lot of time to warm up to the environment. Thankfully, this year, the teachers that he's going to have, he knows very well. So that's another kind of tick. We don't have to worry about that so much. Whereas last year, it was a brand new teacher. And obviously, during lockdown and the first kind of pandemic, he started primary school and he had absolutely no transition. He just went, you know, he had been locked in the house for a while, didn't go to nursery, and then all of a sudden was told to go to this building and in this class. And, you know, so it was really overwhelming. But like you were saying about superpowers, the resilience that boy has shown has just been incredible. I mean, he'll talk to me and he'll express his anxieties and he'll say about his fears and, you know, and we'll talk about it together. But he's very resilient. And obviously, to a point, there's the masking aspect of it as well. But he knows that he has to at least try.
Yeah,
and he's very brave in that respect.
Yeah, well, I mean, the good thing about more awareness and more education around it, and is that hopefully more children will be able to accept themselves and just, you know, come to grips with their own mind a bit more, rather than having to mask quite as much to fit in with everyone and, you know, be the same as everyone else who's boring anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
And neurodivergent people are often really creative people as well, so that's definitely another plus point, I think, of that type of brain.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I know for me and my husband have got similar things, but because he's a kind of combo set, he has autism and ADHD. He's also dyslexic. But he can look at a pile of Lego bricks and he says in his head, it just goes into this 3D kind of model and he knows exactly what he needs, exactly how to build it. Whereas I'm like, yeah, this is a nice wall. You know? I can sit and build Lego when I've got the instructions. That's absolutely fine, but I can't just look at it. And it's anything, paper, boxes, anything. It's amazing that they can do that. And Mason's very much like his dad in that respect.
Oh, brilliant. That's the good thing, isn't it, about recognising the strengths. You know, everyone has their strengths and weaknesses, and whether they have a condition or not, a recognised condition. So yeah, it's just about allowing children to be unique in their own way and not trying to make everyone be the same and fit into a specific mould. And what would you tell other people going through the sorts of issues that you've mentioned in areas that affect your mental health?
I think one of the main things is stay in your own lane. Comparison is a dirty mind trick sometimes. And it can feed so many negative emotions, but your life is yours. And if other people don't understand it, that's on them. That's their baggage. That's things that they need to work through. And it's not your responsibility to try and make them understand how you want to live your life.
Yeah.
Keeping boundaries in place, that's a must. I've not always done that, but for me now, it's a total must. And, you know, don't be afraid to speak up for that energy that you're creating the boundaries for. Make yourself a priority, because unfortunately, more often than not, you're the only one that will.
Yeah, 100%. And I think for women especially, like, women can really feel like they have to make other people comfortable all the time and sacrifice ourselves. And, you know, if a woman does speak up to assert her boundaries, she's often looked at as being bossy or, you know, called a bitch or whatever. And it's just, no, we need more boundaries, definitely. I've definitely got better at that myself the last couple of years. I wasn't even aware of them before the pandemic, I don't think. Certainly not what my own were. And what is your coping method when you're having a bad day?
It seems simple, but I do what I can.
Yeah.
I tell those around me, you know, my husband, my children, you know, any kind of friends or whatever, if they're contacting me, I'll tell them how I'm feeling that day or what I'm experiencing. And I think that's the thing about it, is just having clear communication to them about what I need. And then for myself, I'll make sure to try and resolve things for myself and not look to anybody else to do it.
Yeah.
And for that, I've got my own kind of self-care menu, which is one of the things that Bryony had.
Yeah, I made one.
A lot.
Great.
And I'd never even thought about it before, but it's such a simple thing that has huge, you know, positive impact.
Yeah.
So for me, it could just be taking some time out to reconnect and doing a bit of meditation, and then I might feel okay, I'm better to kind of deal with the situation or the day now. It could just be, like I've said, journaling or listening to music. Sometimes I like to just kind of retreat into myself and go and like read, or if I'm completely overwhelmed, it's usually I'll watch something like a TV series or something that I know like the back of my hand. So yeah, it'll be one that I've watched so many times, but it's that comfort and knowing that I can just sit
there. No surprises.
Yeah.
You know what you're going to get.
And nature for me, it's being out, you know, what movement in nature, or just even simply just standing and hearing everything that's going on around you. It's quite a tranquil feeling.
It really is, yeah. Like being next to a river or something, it's like, especially like a really loud or like fast rushing river, it's like I'm outsourcing like the noise in my head. It's so calming, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think for me, the more difficult the day or the situation, the more time I feel like I need to do for myself.
Yeah, it's those simple things, isn't it? Like a lot of the time when I ask people these kinds of questions, it's like, well, this is really obvious or this is really simple, and it's like, it doesn't have to be a complicated answer, and there is no complicated answer. Like there's no magical solution. It is just the simple things, which is also really reassuring, but it's also why you kind of forget, because you can get so tied up in what's going on that you think it must be a really complex solution that I'm looking for or something really big. But that those self-care menus are just like a really clear reminder of, actually, if I just do any one or any combination of these, they will usually do the job. So it takes the effort out of like the mental energy of trying to think of something. It's a really valuable thing to have. I need to print mine off, actually, because I made it online, and then I thought that would be really handy just to laminate and put on my wall for when I need it.
Yes, definitely.
Make it my phone wallpaper as well, maybe.
Yes. That will post it kind of sizes everywhere.
Yeah. And what was your biggest challenge over the pandemic?
For us, I was obviously on the high risk list. So during the first lockdown, I couldn't go outside, and neither really could the family. My husband kind of went to pick up shops and then came back. And we managed to get out into the garden sometimes, but that was really it. So for somebody like me who needs nature, who needs, you know, that rejuvenation, it was just like my own kind of little version of prison. It just, yeah. It was awful. And obviously when it started, my boys were just 4 and 2. So you've got a 4-year-old who's neurodivergent, who thrives on structure, who's not really getting that now and looking to me to provide it. And then obviously I had to not only kind of be mum and do my own things as well, I then had to become teacher. And then yeah, had to kind
hats
of,
off to you.
You know, and it was a lot. Yeah. And as I said before, my eldest was starting school in between it all.
Yeah.
So that was really, really stressful for us because we had never had a child at school before, because him being our eldest, we didn't know the protocol, we didn't know what we should be doing. We obviously didn't know how much we would be able to comfort him, how far we would be able to go with him, you know, and all these unanswered questions for somebody who is neurodivergent is, you know, it's harrowing to kind of get your head around.
Yeah.
So those were really the most difficult things. And I think for me as well, it kind of mentally made me feel like way back. I mean, I've been chronically ill for 10 years now, mm-hmm. but it was way back when I was first diagnosed. I kind of felt like I was trapped and I was forgotten because I couldn't get out and people, you know, didn't get in touch. They were just so absorbed in their kind of own lives, and I didn't have the energy and things to reach out to them. And I think that was them kind of being like, well, if you don't bother, why should I? And again, they didn't have that understanding. And I kind of felt that that was very similar for our experience. It was especially when people on the high risk list still had to stay in, but other people were allowed to, you know, start going out on
getting
walks,
back to normality,
start to see each other again. Yeah. And it was also the attitude of people around people on the high risk list. I had seen on social media, somebody had said that it's all fine and well if the government want to protect, you know, the vulnerable, but keep them locked in so we can get on with our lives. And it was that, it was, if you've ever had a sentence that could make you feel 2 inches tall, it was that, you know, it was like, why don't I matter? Like, why doesn't my life matter? Why doesn't the life of my family matter? You know, so I think as well, it was more that I saw the real kind of stigma again of people who, you know, aren't as able-bodied.
Yeah, it's really sad. Yeah, I'm sorry you had to go through that. Some people are just completely ignorant, aren't they? And all they were thinking about is getting back to the pub and their own lives. You know, they probably didn't even go through that much hardship. They probably never even bothered to stay in and protect anyone at all. But it was a shame to see like the national sort of attitude and global attitude probably go from, oh, we're all in this together, to people rapidly getting impatient and turning on each other, which is just not helpful at all. That, you know, if there was anyone people should be getting angry at, it's the people in power, but it's not always directed that way, unfortunately.
As
well, just to come back to like the resilience of children, like I don't think children are given enough credit for what they did throughout the pandemic. I mean, you know, it was stressful for everyone, but I couldn't have imagined having to start school as well during that. Like, it's one of the most stressful experiences of our lives, probably, really. But we kind of we forget that because obviously we were so young, we got that out the way early. But it's a big upheaval anyway, isn't it, for a child, never mind in those conditions.
It is. And I just remember, I'm like, you know, us trying to just make sure that like he knew that he was safe at every step, even if I wasn't with him. But it was, I mean, the first day of him going to school, you want to be there just to make sure that that he
Okay.
Was going to go in okay, and that he was going to settle, and I had to leave him at the gate. I couldn't even go past, so I had to watch him kind of just start this new chapter, obviously with a lot of fear and anticipation and, you know, anxiety, and I couldn't do a thing about it. So, yeah, but he did it. And for us, I mean, for any child, that's an amazing thing. But when you're neurodivergent on top of that, to be able to just say, like, you know, I'm just gonna do it, mum. I'm gonna do it.
Oh, bless him. Yeah, it must have been so scary for both of you. But yeah, I mean, some children might just, I think I remember my first day of school, I just didn't want to go in at all, and I had to be persuaded in. I was in a bit of a state, I think, and I'm sure that's like the normality for a lot of children. So yeah, God, that's really brave of him when everyone's been told to stay inside and the big bad world's a scary place. Like, it just, God, it just adds a whole load of extra fear on top of it. But
yeah, definitely.
And what was the surprise positive of the pandemic for you?
I think for us, we definitely became closer as a family.
Yeah.
And we kind of started to see that, wait a minute here, we don't just love each other because, you know, we're linked as husband and wife, or, you know, you're my son. These people are actually my best friends, you know, and it was seeing it very differently, because a lot of people, obviously parenting is stressful, but it was seeing it as, you're actually somebody that I would want to be around if I didn't have this link with you.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
And just seeing, you know, how awesome the characters that my children were becoming. And it was even just the little things, like playing board games or crafting together. And they seemed so small that, you know, you could do any kind of Sunday. But my son still talks about it, like, oh, do you remember when we made those Easter bunny things, Mum? Oh. And, you know, and it's just knowing that that's really resonated with them as well.
Yeah.
And it's just quite heartwarming, really, that in this really difficult time, we still found that kind of bit of togetherness.
Yeah.
But also, it was during the pandemic that I decided to release my first children's book, because I just thought, you know, it was just a clear indication that not everything is going to be the perfect timing.
No.
So you might as well just...
Why not now?
Yeah. Why not now? Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, it's really nice to hear. A few people have said that, you know, about just appreciating they had that time with family that they never would have had otherwise. It's really nice to hear, because I'm sure it wasn't the case for a lot of people. I'm sure it drove, you know, some families or couples apart, because when you're together all the time, it's going to highlight problems that otherwise you might have been able to distract from if things aren't right in a partnership, which, you know, can inevitably happen. So yeah, it is really heartwarming to hear. And what's one thing you wish someone would do when you're having a bad day?
For me, I think that depends on what's causing the bad day. If it's physical pain, or if it's mental overwhelm, or, you know, if it's anxiety. I think understanding and communication can go a long way. Yeah. Knowing that it's okay not to know how to make things better for somebody, but, you know, verbalising that, especially when you're chronically ill or neurodivergent, I don't think people realise that we're not expecting people to make us feel better. We understand that there's not much that they can do to help that situation. But I think a lot of the time as well, it's conditioned for people just to think that admitting that they don't know what to do is some kind of fault, or it's, you know, an imperfection.
Yeah.
And it's really not like that. I would really rather somebody turn around to me and say, I know you're having a bad day, but I'm not sure how to support you.
Yeah.
What is it you need from me? I would much rather somebody just come out and say that rather than them try and pick and choose the wrong words and aggravate me further, really.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the time, it's just allowing me to be and to feel what I need to feel, giving me the space to kind of process it, because most of the time, sorry.
Okay.
Once I've had that, it's a lot easier for me.
Yeah. Yeah, you're so right about just how powerful it can be just to acknowledge how someone's feeling and actually ask them what they need. And even like to flip it around, I've probably thought a lot of the times in the past that I need to come up with a solution for someone when like someone I care about is going through something. It's like try and help them by like suggesting things. That's just not helpful at all a lot of the time, and it's not what they want you to do. They just want you to be there, or they might want something specific, like you say, and the only way you'll find out is by asking them what you can do for them. So it's really useful to know. And what's the best thing you ever did for yourself?
I think for me, it would be not allowing the imposter syndrome to kind of overpower me,
yeah,
and allow me to sign up to Inspire, Write, Repeat, which was is a mentoring and co-writing program by Fiona Thomas. And Fiona has been such an amazing light on my path. She's just a fabulous person, and because of that, I've met so many fabulous people, other writers, and just people who are there to support me and to really, you know, thrive because I'm thriving, and shout out, you know, when they see that I'm growing.
Yeah.
And it's been lovely to build that kind of support network. And it's made me more confident in my own writing abilities also. I'm taking up more space for myself, whereas before I would never have done that. And I would probably, you know, at the start of this year, being like, oh yeah, I've written a book, but, you know, it's just self-published, or, you know, it's something like that. Whereas now I'm like, no, I'm a writer. I'm an author. You know, I'm so much more confident in that, and that's a huge thing for me, because I've never really had a lot of confidence in things that I've done.
Yeah.
And I think as well, it's allowed me opportunities to speak to people like yourself, you know, with just amazing people who want to talk to me about things and want to hear my voice and allow me to get it out there as well.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to be able to recognize it, because, you know, when I hear people say I've written a book, I'm like, wow, like really impressed. But something I've always wanted to do, but often when we like speak about our own achievements, we just like minimize them, don't we? And if we heard someone else say the same thing, we might be more impressed by it, but we just kind of diminish it a little bit in ourselves. And we don't need to do that. It's a good thing to own it and get more confident with it. It's something that I've been working on as well. Like, I did a course called Confidence Now this year with a woman called Kirsty Hull. She's fantastic. That was a big bunch of women all working on being able to shout about their own achievements, basically, and go after what they want. And it's so surprising. Like, you'll be in a room or in a Zoom room with a group of women, and they all seem like so fantastic, like able and gifted and like just really interesting to talk to. And they're saying that they don't have confidence. And if you just had a normal conversation in this room of women, you wouldn't guess. So it's actually a brilliant thing for people to be open about it, and then, you know, help each other kind of move past it and encourage each other to get more confident in our abilities.
Oh, definitely. And I've said that to Fiona many times, that I was convinced that I would join, like, the, you know, the kind of first co-writing session and have like all these other wonderful women as a part of it, and I would just be thinking, no, you know, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
You know, they were going to be like, you know, really snooty, or they were going to be like, oh, you've self-published, or you don't have any, you know, paid articles or anything like that. And that's not at all what I've found.
That's good. It's a really nice thing to realize that most people are actually just really nice, and we build people up in our heads a lot of the time to be more intimidating than they actually are. So yeah, it's fantastic to have those spaces. And what's one thing you'd want to tell the younger you?
Be unapologetically you.
Yeah.
Don't shrink yourself. Mm. Don't hate yourself because you don't fit in. Celebrate it, you know, own everything that you are.
Yeah.
And as well, don't let the opinions of others take any kind of piece of your sparkle.
Mm.
Because that's something that I've done my entire life. Up until recently. So it's definitely something that I wish I had just stopped and kind of had a viewpoint of, actually, I shouldn't be allowing this. Like, they have no right to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really important, isn't it? It's a really similar sort of answer that a lot of people give, actually. You know, just don't worry so much about what other people think, because at the end of the day, it's the voice inside your own head that's going to dictate what you do in life anyway. It's the most important one. You've got to have a good relationship with yourself. It's the one that's either going to beat you up at night when you're trying to go to sleep, or it's going to big you up when you really need it. So yeah, but we're not often told that when we're younger.
No, and that's, you know, as well, you were saying about the voice in your own head.
Mm.
But I think as well, knowing which voice is your own,
yeah,
and knowing which are, you know, all the conditions of other people and the expectations of other people, that's something that I haven't figured out until very recently.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out. Sometimes, yeah. I'm like, is that an intrusive thought, or is that from a real place and it's something that I've buried and it's reminded me of something on purpose? It's, oh God, it's a minefield sometimes figuring out what's real and what's not. And for the last question, what's your go-to song that always lifts your mood?
Oh, goodness. This could have been a whole episode just for this question. Yeah, for me.
A lot of people say that.
Yeah, music was my first boyfriend, my first love.
Yeah.
So I think the first one would definitely be M-Bop by Hanson.
Oh, yeah.
I've been a fan for 25 years, and the song's got much deeper meaning than it presents. Mm-hmm. But it's also a song that 9-year-old me danced to in the summer of 97. But last week I danced to in the car with my boys. So, you know, it's something that's just been there. And
yeah,
just,
still great.
I instantly hear it and I smile. And I don't know if it's an inner child thing or I'm not sure. But it's just such an upbeat song, and just
definitely very upbeat, yeah,
and it's got so much meaning behind it as well.
Yeah.
So another one would be Everywhere by Fleetwood Mac. And I'll Hold My Hands Up, I have danced in supermarket aisles to this song.
Amazing.
I have a unicorn blanket at home specifically for when this song comes on at home. You know, so it's just an awesome song.
Yeah.
And I think my third one would be Get It On by T-Rex.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Because I was brought up on 70s and 80s rock and metal and glam rock and punk and things like that. And T-Rex is a firm favourite. It probably could have been so many other songs of theirs, but for me, it's the starter riff for this one. You just instantly know your mood's just going to change.
Yeah. So. Exactly. Oh, three really good picks there.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for those song choices. I love those three, and I'm going to put them straight on after this. I'm also going to put them on the playlist that I've got for all of my guest tracks. So I'll send you the link for that as well.
Thank you.
It's a really good one to put on shuffle just whenever you need like a boost. I don't think anyone's picked a bad one yet. Obviously, that's a matter of taste, but I think the sort of universally loved ones for the most part.
Yeah.
But thank you for sharing all this. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I'm really excited to share your work as well that you've written. Some fantastic pieces for my site. So thank you for enhancing my website for the launch. I'm really excited to get them out there.
And thank you. It's a wonderful opportunity, both the writing pieces and talking to you today, and really appreciate you taking your time to listen to me talk.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. No problem at all. Well, thanks again, Rochelle, and I'll speak to you really soon. And
thank you very
much. Down.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Oh, how great was Rochelle? I loved talking to her. Not only was she so lovely and funny too, but I learned so much from her through her incredible work. And you're going to love the article she's written for the Same Shit Different Brain website, which is launching very soon. So keep an eye on the social media channels. I hope you enjoyed it, and check out Rochelle on social media to see what she talks about and find the links to her wonderful writing. And if you like the show, please review and give me 5 shiny stars. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.